You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment. You are about to see.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining us this month to talk about the marvelous land of Oz is fellow podcaster and my pal, Tim Price. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Rob. How are you doing?
I am doing great. Thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, I'm glad to do it. I'm trying to remember now. How many shows of yours I've done? It's not been as many as it seems like it should be, but
right.
I'm
so what really are we
glad
talking
on this
about
one.
Here?
That's for,
right.
I've
so done, we did Mountain Comics, right?
Mountain okay. Comics. We did For All Mankind.
All right. So that's two. Have we done Film and Water yet?
No. Okay. No, I haven't. Not yet. I've been pulling for Sneakers, right. But it hasn't come about.
Great
yet.
Great movie.
Oh, fantastic movie. Fantastic movie. And we've done MASHcast, of course.
MASHcast, yeah. So, all right. Okay. So this is number four. So all you need is one more after this. We'll work on it.
Yes.
We'll work. All right. Excellent. Like I said, we'll talk about that off here. So, as yes. I mentioned, we're going to be talking about the marvelous Land of Oz, which was the second and final Wizard of Oz adaptations that Marvel did in the 1970s. Of course, the first one was an adaptation of The Wizard of Oz, which was, in fact, the first ever DC and Marvel co-publication in comics history. It was not Superman versus Spider-Man. It was actually The Wizard of Oz. But we're here to talk about the...
Yeah.
A little fun fact for everybody. Yeah. But we're here to talk about the second book, which is a Marvel-only production, The Marvelous Land of Oz. And we're going to get into all that shortly. But of course, Tim, since this is your first time on the show, I have to ask you, what, if any, history do you have with the Treasury format? Did you have them as a kid? Do you have any of them now?
Well, I'll jump to do I have any now question more, because the answer to that is a bummer and I'd rather focus on the positive. So I'm going to start with the bummer and get it out of the way.
Okay.
And then we'll get to the positive part. The bummer is that I did have quite a few Treasuries as a kid, and I've mentioned it on other shows before that the flood in Joliet of 1981 got all of them.
Oh.
So, you know, it was really awful, but you know, they were in the basement, 6 feet of water came in the basement. What are you going to do? So that's how I go. But I had so many books, it's like they had to be downstairs. My parents were not letting me keep that many comic books upstairs. I had a few of them, including this one that we're talking about today. And my history with them was that mostly it was my folks that would buy them for us for vacation reading material.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. that, you know, they're, and you know, a Treasury was great with the length of that. I mean, they're the length of like four standard comic book stories. And with a huge print and a huge format, you know, you didn't have to carry a whole lot of them. They took up some space, but you didn't have to carry a whole lot of them. And they were really good for killing an hour on the car between breaks. And so we had quite a few of them. If I start rattling them off too much, you can stop me. But like with the JLA, Christmas with the Superheroes, I think we even had a Rudolph one, Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, Avengers, Thor with the Mangog saga. My favorite is one you've already covered, and you know, that's why I have to, like, you know, this is why we got down to this list here, this particular issue. But my favorite was the Superman Spider-Man second one. I didn't get the first one, but I got the second one.
Okay.
And I loved that story. That one I just devoured, and I could reread it repeatedly just without trouble, because I just loved it so much. But yeah, and we had this issue here, Marvelous Land of Oz. You know, I was the right age for this too. I was about 7-8 years old when this issue came out, and had seen The Wizard of Oz more than once by that time. It was on every Easter, like everybody from that era might remember. And you know, seeing this here and seeing the live action kind of versions of Scarecrow and Tin Man here in a comic book format, just delightful. But yeah, this is so it just they would buy any books that, you know, would keep us. Help keep us keep us entertained for the trips, you know, including like those Whitman three packs.
Love those things.
Oh yeah. Still got to
hated them as a kid. I love them now.
Oh yeah, exactly. Although I kind of wonder if my folks would have really been happy with the Conan issues that came in a few of them. Because oh my goodness, some of the women in those Conan issues, I'm just gonna tell you right now. I'll just leave it at that. Some of the women in those issues. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so the Treasury edition, you know, a lot of affection for that. Do I have any nowadays? No, not really. I have some of the Marvel graphic novels from the 80s, which are close to this format, but you know, and I have nostalgia for it because they had some amazing things that you otherwise wouldn't have seen, you know, an interesting way of reproducing some of the stories.
So you have not felt compelled to go when you're at cons, because I mean, you go to cons all the time. We've been at the same con for Pete's sakes. You don't feel compelled to go pick them up when you see them at dealers. I know part of it is probably cost, because they're just, especially at cons, right, the prices are through the roof.
Yeah, that's the main thing, I think, is that, you know, these treasuries are understandably very valuable. So it's like, no, I haven't really felt the itch to do that. But then I'm also actively trying to downsize my physical collection as it is.
Aha. Okay.
So,
all right.
You know, it's kind of hard to justify both directions on that front.
I actually thought you were, I think you were with me when we were at the Boston Comic Con and we were looking at a pile of treasuries and somebody was selling the Welcome Back Cotter treasury for $50. And I was like,
oh, I remember $50. Yes, I do remember that. I really remember that. And
what are you, nuts?
For Welcome Back Cotter.
Welcome Back Cotter? $50? Because John Travolta was at the con. And I had this idea of like, well, that'd be kind of a fun thing to get him to sign. But I was like, $50? Like, what are you, crazy? So, yeah.
That, I think the other thing on that is, you know, it does show the interest in it as a collectible and not so much as a story. If you're going to buy the Welcome Back Cotter today, you're not buying it because you think you're going to get a fantastic story out of it. You're getting it because of the novelty of getting the Welcome Back Cotter treasury. Because who the heck would have that?
Yeah. Completely, completely. So, okay. So you obviously had them as a kid. So were they plentiful? Were you at newsstands that you got comics? Cause I didn't, the stores in my general area didn't sell them, like 7-Eleven and stuff. They didn't stock treasury. Okay. It was only when we were in kind of special local, like a Woolworths, which is like a, for people who don't remember, that was like a local chain in the sort of the Northeast sort of thing. But I mean, I had to go to specific stores to get them. They weren't just available where I normally got my comics.
Well, as I said, since I wasn't really buying them, my folks were. It's like I, being a totally uninquisitive kid, I never really found out how they got them.
Oh, they just handed them to you. Nice.
They could. Yeah, exactly. They just handed them to me. But, and I think it's also my mom was a pretty good advocate of comics. My dad, not so much, because my dad was a much more of a scholar and wanted book reading. But my mom probably was one who was more like, oh, let them have their fun.
They're reading. So, they're reading it all.
Yeah,
so
they're reading something. They'll be quiet in the car and not the three of them bickering in the back seat. Like, so it's like, yeah, I can't blame her for that. I cannot blame her one bit because that's what we would have done. But I have to think that it couldn't have been hard for her to find. I have to think we had dime stores in our area and the drug stores and things like that probably might have had them on their newsstands. You know, definitely not spinner rack sort of thing, but they probably had them on the magazine racks. That's where I would imagine they had them. This was, you know, like this was early to late 70s. So and in the Chicago area, we were not necessarily, we didn't live right in Chicago itself proper, but you know, we were like on the suburbs and one city was a little bit further away for a long time. So it just, that kind of area, I think just lived and breathed comics. There's you could find until I started collecting. And then all of a sudden it became hard to find comics. What the heck?
Thanks, comics That's industry. Fair. Well done.
Yeah. Thank you.
The reason I ask that is because I always just find it fascinating at the idea that like parents, when they have kids that are either too young to shop for themselves or like your parents are kind of preempting the family squabbles in the back of the station wagon that they're out buying comics. Like I just love the idea of parents trying to navigate what they think their kid would like. You know what I mean? Like just I'm trying to picture your parents like looking at like Superman versus Spider-Man, The Mighty Thor, Conan, Marvelous Land of Oz, and they're just kind of like, which one are we? And like,
right.
We put our parents through these things that we don't really appreciate at the time. Because the one example I always use is like when my parents got me Star Wars figures as for Christmas. And it's like I'm trying to picture my father who, you know, barely could follow the Star Wars movie. He liked them, but he, you know, really didn't follow them the way I did as a nerd, trying to like figure out which one was the Uggonaut, you know, like, my poor father, it's like trying to, is this pig guy? What is that? You know,
That, I'll give you the thought that from my folks buying for us, based upon what they bought, they were doing a pretty good job of just going by what they saw us watching on TV, you know, because the Justice League of America, well, the kids watch Super Friends. They have all these guys on here all the time. Right. Yep. We watched the Spider-Man cartoon from the 60s on reruns. So that's an easy win. And, you know, Land of Oz, we'd seen the movie The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, right. Yeah, exactly.
There you go.
Yeah.
You
know? Even your dad would be happy with that because it's kind of kind of literary.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And, you know, Rudolph, it's like we watched all the Christmas specials every year. So that they had those things to go on. Now, some of the other ones that they picked up, it's like hard to say what, but it's also kind of like a, you know, buying Thor. It's like, oh, wait, buying, we're not really, it's not for the, you don't buy Thor for the mythology. I'm sorry. No, no, I'm sure I'm offended all the Norse worshipers out there, but
Gene Hendricks,
you don't buy modern
Thor. He's shaking his fist at clouds right now.
I know. I'm sorry, Gene. Jack Kirby was not being, Jack Kirby's Mangog era, probably not in the mythology. Just
that is shocking news to me.
I know. but there are also other, but there even was like the Marvel superheroes cartoon, which had like the five stars, Captain America, Iron Man, Thor, Submariner, Hulk. So it's like, if you had a hint of it from that, you know, that might have been it, but it's also probably just say, hey, let's look at a pretty fancy, colorful thing. And of our three kids, boy, Tim seems the most quietest when there's a comic book under his face. So get him some more.
There you go. Perfect. Absolutely perfect.
And I can't gainsay that thought pattern.
All right. So, okay. And related to that, are you a particular fan of the Wizard of Oz kind of, I don't want to say franchise. It's not a franchise, but there were toys in the '70s. There were Amigo line of dolls and there was a sequel, Return to Oz. And there was the Great and Powerful Oz just a couple of years ago, the Sam Raimi movie. Like, or is it just that it was Wizard of Oz? And of course, in the '70s, every kid watched Wizard of Oz every year. Cause it was, you mentioned, it was a huge event that they showed it on TV every year. So it's like Wizard of Oz was the kind of thing there where for myself, I watched it every year with my family. The minute I got old enough to choose my own things, I stopped watching it. Not cause it's not a great movie. It's a classic, but it was, you didn't have a choice back then. Kind of, it was like everybody watched Wizard of Oz, you know?
Right.
So were you like a particular fan of Oz outside of that context?
I wouldn't say so, except that we did have the soundtrack of the songs on a gigantic LP. And my brother, sister, and I would actually just play the album on our own and sing along with it throughout the year. So we enjoy, but you know, we have enough of musical theater love between the three of us that was part of it. So we just love the songs. We just sing along with the songs and kind of maybe we'd have our own toys act out things on occasion, but it was mostly just, you know, that's still following the movie, but we couldn't watch the movie. So, but I wasn't really branching out into other things. I'm quite sure I haven't seen any of the movies, but I did read the novel of The Wizard of Oz, I think in junior high. And I think I even read Land of Oz in junior high as well, but I didn't get past that. I think that was whether that because I stopped or because my library didn't have any of the other books, not really sure. But I think I went that far with it.
Wow.
I don't really remember them very well. Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
that's it's a deeper knowledge than most people, certainly. So, okay. Well, perfect.
And we should also just briefly mention that Scotty Young's revival of the Oz series for Marvel a few years back, huge commercial success, huge critical success. And I did read those on Marvel Unlimited. In fact, it was one of the first things I started reading with my kids. And that was great fun. We just tore through those books quite, you know, we'd read just one comic a night and it was a great, great time going through those. So that's another angle on it, but that was more of a modern adult parent kind of relationship with Oz rather than my own fandom, but I still enjoyed them. They were still, you know, great reads.
Oh, good. Okay. I've never read those. That's interesting. Okay, cool. All right. Well, so let's talk about this comic. You said it's called The Marvelous Land of Oz. It was on sale November 11th, 1975. As I mentioned, it was the second and final Marvel adaptation of the Frank L. Baum books. It's by Roy. It's adapted by Roy Thomas and Alfredo Alcala. Now, before I get to the plot synopsis, let me talk about the cover a little bit. Of course, you'll be able to see this in the gallery. The cover is by John Romita, not by Alfredo Alcala. And we see the Tin Man as sort of we recognize him, and the Scarecrow. And then there's two new characters that, if you haven't read this book yet or familiar with the comic, you're kind of like, who is that? Jack Skellington? What's going on there? I don't know what that is. And they're flying in this thing, and it talks about their back. The Scarecrow and the Tin Man. And wait till you see what's new in Oz. And it even says at the banner there, Marvel Treasury of Oz, not even Marvel Treasury Edition, Marvel Treasury of Oz. So what did you think of this cover, Tim?
This cover is really gorgeous. I love the detail on it. It doesn't look very John Romita. I don't know what it is. I think it's the face of the young boy whose name is Tip. Doesn't quite look like a Romita face, but that's okay. It doesn't have to, but I would not have, if I didn't see his signature on one of the gigantic feathers on it, I wouldn't have known it was him really. But I like the image. I like them. They're flying over the Emerald City. The Scarecrow has gotten himself falling out of the contraption that they're flying in. The tintinabulating Tin Man. Oh, wow, that's a great one to say. is desperately trying to hold on to him, and Tip is holding on to the Tin Man. And Murph Pumpkinhead is there in the front, holding on to the antler of this thing we'll find out is called a Gump. His name isn't Merv. It's Jack Pumpkinhead, by the way, just for the listeners. But if you know Merv Pumpkinhead from Sandman, it's not far off from that either.
Yeah. So. Actually, that's closer to Jack's than it is to Jack Skellington. I should have made that reference actually a little bit better. Yeah. I will say by labeling this comic and on the indicia, it literally is listed as Marvel Treasury of Oz. Makes this book impossible to find on a Google search, by the way.
Yeah.
Marvel was worried about that in 1975. But as a modern day comic book chronicler, it's a pain in the ass because it's really hard to find these books.
What's also kind of funny is that the title of the original novel is also Marvelous Land of Oz. And of course, having the word Marvel in the title of the book as well is of course a marketing brilliance that they thankfully didn't miss out on. They did not let DC snatch this one up.
Yeah, it's right there, everybody. It's right there. we have not actually covered the Wizard of Oz adaptation yet on the show. Maybe we'll get to it at some point. And while that is a DC and Marvel collaboration, it's mostly a Marvel book. It's done by Marvel staff. Mm-hmm. It was published by Marvel. DC sort of slapped their logo on it, and it was kind of a way just to head off the idea that they were both going to produce an adaptation around the same time, and they realized, well, we're cannibalizing each other's business, so let's collaborate. Mm-hmm. But it's essentially a Marvel comic, just happens to have a DC bullet on it. When it came time to do further adaptations, Marvel took over. And so there's no DC involved in this at all. So, okay, the story is called The Marvelous Land of Oz, that we talked about. It's by Roy Thomas and Alfredo Alcala. Not long after Dorothy Gale left Oz and returned to Kansas, a boy named Tip decides to get revenge on the cruel witch Mombi, who is his guardian. Using a pumpkin and some sticks, he creates a scarecrow-like figure, which he names Jack Pumpkinhead, using Mombi's magical powers to make him come alive. Mombi is not scared by this, however, and tells Tip she will use her powers to turn him into marble. Before she can, Tip and Jack Pumpkinhead, as well as a wooden sawhorse that has also been given life, run away. But Tip and his two creations get separated, and he runs into General Ginger and her all-girl army, who plan to take over the Emerald City from control of its new ruler, the Scarecrow, who became king after the great and powerful Oz was revealed to be a fraud. Ginger's army attacks, and Tip, Scarecrow, and Jack escape to another kingdom ruled by the Tin Man. They plan to try and reclaim the city, but Mombi intervenes and diverts them. On this diversion, they meet another being, Wogglebug, who joins them along with his pack of loyal field mice who hide inside the Scarecrow's straw body. Back at the Emerald City, Ginger and her army arrest our heroes, but the mice escape and scare the soldiers out of the castle. Trapped inside, Tip and the rest build a flying machine and escape the palace of Glinda the Good Witch. Glinda tells them that a young girl named Ozma is a direct descendant of the Pastoria, who ruled Emerald City before Oz took it over by force. That means Ozma is the true ruler of Emerald City, something the Scarecrow, who never wanted to be ruler in the first place, is happy to hear. Glinda joins them and they find Mommy, who under duress reveals that the wizard brought her Ozma to get her out of the way, whom Mommy transformed into Tip. Tip is at first horrified to learn this, but he accepts his destiny and Mommy turns him back into a girl, Ozma. Ginger's army is defeated. Scarecrow and Jack join the Tin Man in his kingdom, and Ozma makes her position as the rightful ruler of Oz. Wow. Tim.
First off, that was a fantastic synopsis of a bonkers story.
Holy crap.
That's that is fantastic, because so much happens in this book.
I read the, look, I'm sure when I bought this treasury 20 years ago, I read it once to just, you know, oh, I've never read it. Let me read it. Right. So I had no memory of it when I sat down to read it. And I've never seen Return to Oz, the mid-80s film, which supposedly is sort of a loose adaptation of this. But my Lord, the amount of stuff Frank L. Baum crams into this book. It is startling. And like I said, from that synopsis, thank you for the credit, by the way, that synopsis leaves out about half the crazy shit that happens in this story. I mean, Frank L. Baum was just burning on all thrusters on this, this kind of thing. So again, we'll talk about the details, and we're going to talk about the art and whatever. But overall, like, what is your feeling about this just as a comic book? Not necessarily an adaptation, but just as a, as a 80 page comic.
Well, flashing back to myself when I first read it as a kid, I was just along for the ride. It was a roller coaster sort of story. You know, with all the twists and turns and just the insanity and just the fantasy of it, you know, the fantasy of like bringing things to life. A witch is going to turn you into a statue. You're actually transformed from a girl, meeting our familiar characters from, The Wizard of Oz. It's very much a fun fantasy romp, and I enjoy just rolling through it, and just like so many concepts are thrown at you just to keep things hopping, so many different things, and I just find it very eminently entertaining. I was always entertained by it, and on the reread I felt the same way. I don't really feel like I got nostalgia from it. I feel like it's been divorced enough from me that I didn't have that kind of association with it. I was able to read it and just go, oh yeah, I remember that bonkers thing. That was crazy. And just enjoying along with it. And it's now, one thing that's interesting is that on the artwork, it's almost, I don't want it to sound negative, but like some points capturing the movie likeness of the Scarecrow and the Tin Man is the only thing that kind of throws me. It's almost Uncanny Valley-like, but their appearance suits the comic book medium very well. So my brain kind of is going through this cognitive dissonance in like, wait, these look like real people. It's like, but they're real people who played fictional people. So that's okay. And then you'd have other characters that are in there who just look like, yeah, these are not real. These are not based on real people. These definitely are Oz characters, you know, and it doesn't seem as jarring. But I just find it very entertaining, and it's like it's a fascinating look at the next chapter of seeing the movie. It does feel like you're kind of like getting into the next chapter of that. So you just can't divorce. I can't divorce myself from the movie experience,
sure,
because that was such, you know, baked into your DNA if you were growing up in that era and you saw it every Easter with your whole family. You know, you can't disassociate the two things. But I felt like it just really kind of was a nice thing for building on that, while also being so much, clearly they also state in the book itself that this is based upon the novel, and thus there's most elements that you might remember from the movie, that the movie changed to fit that format. They did the novel version instead here, so it's like a little bit of a continuity difference, but again, it was like, it didn't really throw you when you're reading it. You just went with it because you're already on the roller coaster. No point getting off now. So I really just enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. What did you think about it, though?
It really is a roller coaster. And I do have when it comes to comic book stories or fiction in general or movies, I do have a little problem with outright fantasy, because I feel like there are no rules. You know, it's just anything can happen. Anything can happen. And that's you know, that's what happens here. You know, it's like, oh, okay, there's this little boy and there's a, and he, you know, okay. And his guardian is a witch. Okay. Well, that's pretty classic setup. All right. And she has some magic dust and he uses it to turn the, you know, this sort of pile of sticks and a pumpkin into a live being. Okay. All right. Fine. But then you've got the pile of sticks becomes like a little horse, kind of like a dog. And you're like, okay. And then you've got this Wogglebug character. Like there's so many concepts being thrown at you. And so you mentioned that you read the book. Were though I should know this, but like, are those picture books or are they just prose? Cause I'm trying to imagine trying to describe all this without any visuals, like what that could possibly read like.
The ones I read were prose novels with illustrations leading the chapters.
Okay. So like spot illustrations. Okay.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
So it's more like that to kind of help bring them to life.
Gotcha. All right. I mean, cause it's just,
and that's one thing about why this feels like a whole lot goes in here is that by being an adaptation of a novel in a single 80 page comic book, no wonder it feels cramped.
Yeah. You know, I mean,
even a movie adaptation in 80 pages is kind of a stretch, but also they kind of almost match it's a little bit easier on the math to make a movie that's 90 to 120 minutes to fit in a Treasury edition, but to make any size novel fit in there, you are streamlining like crazy or taking out stuff you don't need, or you're cramming a lot in.
It really is sort of startling of how much they throw into this. Now, visually, let's talk about again, we mentioned John Romita, but the book itself is drawn by Alfredo Alcala. Now, Alfredo Alcala, legendary comic book artist, you know, from decades and decades of work, both at Marvel and DC. What do you think of Alfredo Alcala as, are you a fan particularly of his work?
I don't think I'd really say that I'm a fan of his work, because that's like, I'm sure I've seen it in other places, but I haven't sought it out and it's not a style that I recognize. But I found a lot of what he did here worked very well. I thought he was really well suited to the book. His background in more of the horror things before now kind of works in making him someone who can put a certain degree of realism next to things that are surreal. And they kind of work that way. So I do like that contrast that he brings. So I found him a good fit. I found him a good fit for this particular story.
I will say that when he is a penciler and an inker, I really like his work a lot. When he often in '80s, he was paired up with other pencilers and he's an inker. And as an inker, I think the stuff is beautiful to look at, but he smothers his pencilers. I mean, his style is so heavy handed. That, to me, virtually any artist who's inked by Alfredo Alcala, it just looks like Alfredo Alcala. He just can't help it. But when he draws, you know, when he pencils as well as inks, then it's great. I mean, you mentioned kind of like there's these whimsical stuff. There's all this whimsical stuff in here. Again, you've got this Wogglebug looking type character and the sawhorse that comes alive and, you know, the pumpkin, Jack Pumpkinhead. And that's all very fanciful and silly. But then like on page 13, there's a giant close up of Mombi the witch and she could be right out of a Conan comic book. Like she's gnarled and full of these creases and she's genuinely frightening. And I'm like, yeah, that's our Fred Alcala's really digging into it. And you could see Alfredo Alcala has the kind of style that you could see if you did it in black and white, his stuff would work as spot illustrations for like Marvel's Land of Oz, the book. It has that kind of classic style. So he's a good choice. I think he's a good choice. I know what you're saying about the likenesses. To me, they look vaguely like Ray Bolger and Jack Haley. But not that those faces are that recognizable, but it was like, okay, yeah, those are the versions that I know of, and they seem to be recognizably the characters from the original book. I did like the notion of the Scarecrow becomes king of the Emerald City kind of by default, and then we find out later he's like, I don't want to do this. I really don't. I like that detail. You're like, oh, yeah, he just wants to just be like a regular dude. He doesn't really want to rule anything. Pace-wise... Like, I like Tip is our main character, and then the Scarecrow and the Tin Man are along for the ride, which is interesting. I mean, it kind of goes against as far as I know, in the original Wizard of Oz book, the whole it was all a dream thing, that's not in the book, right? That's a movie invention, that the whole ending sequence, because obviously Oz is not a dream, because look where we are in the second book. Mm-hmm. This is all really happening.
Now, the thing is that it's been a while since I've read the conclusion of the book, so I'm trying to remember how well it ended, but I think they left it a little bit more ambiguous in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, then they put that to rest by having the very next story be set in Oz like this.
Yeah.
So, but I think they might have left it a little ambiguous, more for the fact that the Auntie M and Uncle Owen? No, that's the uncle from Star Wars. Never mind. But the uncle weren't sure if it was a dream, but the reader could tell that the reader might be like, no, that wasn't a dream, that was real. So I don't know.
Yeah. Uncle Owen is this, I think all of our nerd brains just default to Owen.
That's when you're right.
Uncle, you just go immediately to uncle.
I do have a picture in my head from the original book, a spot illustration that we were talking about, of Dorothy kind of running back to her house for mm-hmm. the last chapter.
Okay.
So that's one thing I have in my head. Whether or not that's accurate, I'm not sure. But that's kind of, but you know, also like she had magic shoes to get her home too.
Right.
So I think that's more of a thing.
On a purely commercial level, I find it interesting that Frank L. Baum chose to bring us a new protagonist for this second story, mm-hmm. as opposed to bringing Dorothy back. And though, right. you know, mm-hmm. they weren't thinking about that kind of stuff in the same way back then. But nowadays we'd be like, mm-hmm. no, we got to get Dorothy back into Oz. You know what I mean? We're not going to have a separate new right. character.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have, and he doesn't do that. So Dorothy and the Cowardly Lion do not appear in this story at all, except for a cameo which is the classic shot of the four of them walking down the Yellowbrick Road. But I mean, they're not in this story at all, which again, I, mm-hmm. you know, was sort of pleasantly surprised at that it takes such a kind of turn, and it's its own little separate thing, and it's not connected to the main events of the first film, which again, you would imagine that would be kind of a smart commercial thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not really sure about what they were, if they really were thinking about that as greatly, or if the first novel was really such a huge success that they felt like they needed to be on top of the marketing, or if it's just like, if Frank L. Baum's first book was like, oh, it did okay. Yeah. Why don't you do another one?
Mm-hmm.
And he's just like, okay, well, I'll just make another one. He just did a story that he wanted to do. He didn't just wasn't really pushed into it yet. And I could kind of think that maybe by the third or fourth book, and then it became, oh, this is a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah.
You need to be, this is a, you are, you have something going here. Make it, you know, milk it for what you can. where like the third book has Dorothy come back, as we see that at the end of this issue, when they highlight what the third issue that never comes.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
was also a thing from my childhood. It's like, wow, there's a third issue coming. Boy, I wonder if I'll ever get a chance to read that.
Yeah. We will talk about that. That's definitely a piece of the trivia here in this, of this Wizard of Oz mm-hmm. series. I will say, when I got to the, you know, the third part of the story, or the fourth part or whatever, and we get this in really, eye-opening turn, where we learn that, mm-hmm. You know, there's this whole secret family that, you know, used to run the Emerald City, and they were sort of deposed violently by the wizard, and the baby was, the rightful ruler was escorted off to another planet of Tatooine. Oh, wait, sorry. I'm getting confused again. But we learn here that Ozma, thanks to Mombi, was turned into a boy, and the Tip is like, wait, I'm a girl, and I mean, good Lord, keep this book out of Florida, apparently, because it would be illegal. it was a really startling turn. And talk, I mean, Frank L. Baum, man, so woke.
This is not actually a joke, Rob, because you know, I do have to wonder if Land of Oz is banned. It would not surprise me.
Yeah,
so many books have been banned. It's like, it would not surprise me at all if the second book was banned in some states right now.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm being a smart ass about it, but yeah, really, it's and also, you know, like they deal with it too. They deal with the notion of Tip is like, I don't want to be a girl. And it's not because it's like, oh, girls are icky. It's just, he doesn't want to be transformed into something he is not familiar mm-hmm. with, which is that pretty heavy stuff for a story that right. features such fantastical, silly elements. It's a pretty mm-hmm. heavy turn right near the end of the story. I was genuinely, I got to, I was like, what? Like, I did not see that one coming at all.
Now, how old would you say Tip is portrayed here in this book?
He's got to be like 10, 11, yeah, I was, 9.
I'm thinking the same like thing, like somewhere 8 to 10 yeah. is what I'm thinking. He's very short.
Yes.
So I feel like that's probably the main thing where I'm going by 8 to 10. So it's like, yeah, from a maturity level, it's like, that's not the age we kind of really expect to have true understanding of gender identity and things like that just yet from someone who's been living another way. You know, yeah. It's like, he doesn't know. So it's dealt with as well as it can be dealt with from a book that was published in 1975 based on a book that was published in 1907. So.
Yeah. It was
a big twist.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing yeah. turn. I said I had no memory of it. But Tip eventually decides, okay, I really kind of want to fulfill my destiny. And Mombi mm-hmm. turns him into Ozma. And then he said after they defeat the Ginger's army and then they take over, he reclaims the rightful throne to Oz, and Scarecrow and the Tin Man decide to go off back to his kingdom. And I mean, it's a really sweet ending, and especially the final page, which again I'll feature in the gallery post, of Ozma sitting on the throne is beautifully rendered by Alfredo mm-hmm. Alcala. I mean, it looks like kind of like a sort of like an Enfants Mucha sort of thing a little bit. It's really, really wonderfully done. And so, like I said earlier, I have a little tough time with fantasy when it's so out there. Because I just feel like there's no rules. And once there's no rules, I kind of mm-hmm. get a little lost. That's Star Wars is like the furthest fantasy I go. Cause that's like science fiction fantasy, but this mm-hmm, is right. really out there. And again, I know that there is the Return to Oz movie from the '80s, which again, I've not seen. I'm startled to imagine like how much of that they tried to adapt into
right.
from this story. Cause it just seems, really, really ambitious, but it's overall just as a comic book. I did enjoy it. I did enjoy all of the action beats to it. It was nice seeing, again, the Scarecrow and the Tin Man in kind of another context. I mentioned it was beautifully drawn by Alcala. And you could tell that Roy Thomas mm-hmm. just loves this stuff. Like, he could just sink. I mean, like, almost anything. He just sinks his teeth yeah. into it. And so, overall, as a package, as a comic book, I mean, there is a little bonus feature talking about the Oz books and stuff by Roy Thomas. And then there's mm-hmm. a map. The Land of Oz, and it talks about the different sort of countries with it make up Oz. Mm-hmm. There's Munchkin Country and the Winky Country and the Quenang Country and stuff like that.
Do you like maps in your books and in your comics?
They're fun. It's a fun bonus feature. It kind of reminds you of the stuff mm-hmm. we would see with Conan, where it was like,
yeah,
this okay. is where Conan mm-hmm. traveled. What about you?
I tend to eat them up, but also I tend to go like, I never retain them very well. So it's like, boy, I appreciate them being there. And it's like, oh, this is cool. But then as soon as I put it away, it's like, forget about it.
I mean, they have like three extra pages to fill. So there were four. Mm-hmm. So they're like, okay, it's a nice little double page spread kind of thing. And it gives you a sense of like how big this place is. But then at the end of the book, the last page, and again, we'll have this in the gallery post, features an ad, coming Oz Tractions next issue. Ozma of Oz, co-starring Scarecrow, Tin Man, and introducing TikTok. Oh, that's timely. The Hungry Tiger, the Yellow Hen, and the Nefarious Home King. And it also features, and we see them pictured here, the Cowardly Lion and Dorothy. And this ad is drawn by John Romita, but he's using a slightly different kind of style. It's got a little more feathering and cross-hatching, and it's mm-hmm. really beautiful. It's an absolutely gorgeous ad, and it actually even gives an on sale date of February 3rd, 1976. And I will tell you, Tim, back when I was finishing my treasury collections, as I was working on my treasury comics website, I spent more hours than I should have looking for this book and wondering why I couldn't find it. And then I had to learn it was never published, despite the fact that it was finished. Like, they even had word balloons right. pasted on the pages. It never got published because apparently this one did not sell terribly well. the treasuries in general weren't doing terribly well for Marvel, according to Roy Thomas in an article in Back Issue. And so the whole book got scrapped, which seems...
Wow.
The fact that it's finished and you've already paid for it, you've paid the artist, you've paid Roy Thomas, it seems strange to say, we're just going to eat that and put the pages in a drawer and they will never be seen again, as opposed to like, well, let's publish it. We can make a couple of bucks off it. But no, Ozma of Oz does not exist.
That's a crying shame. Because, you know, based upon the artwork we've seen on all this so far, for that alone, I'm sure it's a picturesque book.
Oh,
I'm sure it's going to be just lush with artwork. Boy, if somebody has it in a drawer somewhere, maybe we can hold out hope that they'll digitize it. Maybe we can just hold out hope that somehow it would come out. But it's like, yeah, that's just bizarre. I have to think that if the publishing cost of the actual printing cost alone was the main thing that they were like, we just can't. That would be a bridge too far in terms of expense. That might be the only explanation, but it is a shame.
I've heard that story enough times across DC and Marvel that obviously publishing something like that, there must be just more costs involved than I'm aware of, because DC did the same thing to the Jerry Conway, Nestor Redondo, King Arthur treasury, which was like supposedly like 90% finished, and then they scrapped it. And, you know, it must be more than just printing it is something like that, but it's a damn shame. But yeah, I would think these pages are in a drawer somewhere in the Marvel offices, somewhere in some deep vault. Maybe not. Like you said, maybe hopefully they were digitized at some point. I mean, part of the thing they ran into apparently is there is a fourth book in the series, which is not, out of copyright. Now, maybe it is by this point, but in 1970, in the mid 1970s, it was not. It was still, I guess they had that like 70 year rule if that was still in effect, if that was in effect.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah.
But so the fourth book, they would have had to pay the Baum estate. And I guess Marvel was like, we're not doing that. So they just dropped it. But again, what a damn shame that you would have a finished to the point where they're giving you a publication on sale date. That seems like, God, the book seems like it's ready to go. You know, it's just,
yeah.
And the ad is just so pretty. It's just so gorgeously drawn by John Romita that it's like, oh man, what a loss. What a loss.
Right. Well, we even get it, and we get a taste of that too on the back cover of this book with just that back cover image, which is just another presentation of the characters in the story. But John Romita's got to be the one drawing this one too.
It is. Yeah. You can see his name down on the bottom. And if you look at the cover, it looks style wise. And in terms of just the way the figures are posed, it looks like a classic Marvel cover. You could swap out these figures for Thor, you know, Spider-Man, put a bit Dr. Doom in the center. You know, I mean, it looks like a Marvel. It's colored like a Marvel cover. Cause of course it is. But I mean, it's that, you know, Romita was the Marvel house style of the 70s. There's a reason why his work is used on like most of the merchandising and things like that. So it looks like something that if you didn't know these characters already, you'd say, oh, these are just Marvel characters. You know, it just has that look to it. So yeah, it's a beautiful image. It's overall a really handsome package. Marvel did a great job. And if you're a Wizard of Oz fan, I mean, you were really living high on the hog in the 70s because the movie was run, as we just talked about. It was run every year. It was a giant event. And I mentioned Mego had a line of toys. Now, I never had them. I had World's Greatest Superheroes and I had Star Trek and I had a lot of other their figures, but I didn't have Wizard of Oz. But have you ever seen the Mego line of Wizard of Oz dolls?
No, I'm afraid I haven't seen them.
They're beautiful. They're beautifully done. If you're an Oz collector, if you're an Oz person, the box are beautiful. There's like Glinda, and they did a playset. They did they did like a Glinda castle. So, I mean, man, if you were an Oz fan, and they not to get too far off this comic, but Mego really rolled out the red carpet, as it were, because they had a unveiling of them at the Waldorf Astoria, I believe with Ray Bulger and like Jack Haley or something. I mean, they really put a lot of money. So they're, if you're a Oz/doll collector, you probably really love these things. So yeah, if you're a Wizard of Oz fan, there was a lot to you could get the Marvel comic, you could get the dolls, mm-hmm. you could watch the movie. I mean, there was a lot going on in the '70s for in terms of this franchise. Oh,
yeah. So definitely it is a thing where it's like, yeah, it's a franchise. It was definitely a franchise, and they probably had other collectibles that you could get, you know, even before that. I'm sure that, you know, there's Oz lunchboxes out there.
Oh yeah. All sorts of merch. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a constantly renewable resource. And so you said it's overall, mm-hmm. it's a really nice book. I enjoyed reading it again. That story turn was genuinely shocking, which, you know, I don't really think I get shocked mm-hmm. reading comics much anymore, other than, oh God, I used to like this kind of stuff, and then I put it off to the side. But I mean, you know, I didn't remember that. I didn't remember that turn at all. And it's just such a shame mm-hmm. that this was it. This was two and done. And then never again, until, as we talked about, Marvel eventually started doing that. And they did a Marvelous Land of Oz miniseries later on.
Yes.
And and those were very, as you mentioned, they were very popular and they were big successes. So, yeah, but, you know, as an treasure book, this probably would not have been something I got as a kid. If I had my choice, if I'd been in a store and they had a bunch of treasuries, I definitely would have gone for the superheroes and Star Wars. But, I love that I have it now. And again, it's a great book. As we're wrapping up here, anything else we want to say about Wizard of Oz or this book in general before we sign off, Tim?
Well, a couple of things I'd love to point out just on some key points of the art is like on page 17, where Tip is kind of talking about the adventures of Dorothy mm-hmm. and her friends and meeting the wizard. And like, there's this panel at the top where they're encountering the disembodied gigantic head of wizard with flame and everything. And I'd swear this is a superhero panel right in the middle of this comic book mm-hmm. because the way that the character all poses, like it's the Avengers meeting Dr. Doom sort of panel right there. It is great. And it just jumps out at me like that. So I love that. And I also can't help but just to a degree, it makes me go, what? But also I kind of dig the inconsistencies and things they do that just that don't actually make sense. Like when they saw the ears onto the sawhorse, it's like, how did they get wood up onto his ear when he was already at a flat head? It says you have to dig into it to get wood out for his ear. Oh, never mind.
Just to let put it go. To paraphrase Michael Bailey, because Oz, you know, because it's what happens.
Pretty here. Much.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The characters in the Emerald City are pretty great. I mean, one of the gatekeeper is kind of funny because the gatekeeper should be based upon Frank Morgan, who played the wizard, because he played the gatekeeper also. But this is not based on that. It is just a original depiction of a character. So it's one of those things where if you're just being nitpicky, that you would go like, well, if they made the other characters consistent, why did they make, no, it's fine.
I wonder if it's like a rights thing, you know, like some actors signed off on it, thing. Some didn't, you know?
Yeah, a likeness thing. Yeah, I also like, I don't know how old Frank Morgan, and if he was around at this time, I don't know.
Yeah, he might have been gone. I mean, like the one shot we have of Dorothy, it doesn't look like Judy Garland.
No.
You know?
No, definitely not.
Yeah.
And they have the funny thing, like the soldier with green whiskers who just like, he's a comical character, and you know, he's a string bean with a ginormous beard that goes down to his feet. It's like, yeah, they're just having fun with all these things. But Emerald City looks great, and we had like this little character Jellia Jam. It's like these names are like, and it's one of those things where I'm trying to remember that these are Roy Thomas's big job was adapting Baum's work here and trying to pick and choose what he could fit in and what could make a cohesive story and not crediting Thomas with the story too much itself, because like, no, he got it from the original book. So it's not his, but it's, you know, but it's like he still had to pick what to use. And so also some of the inconsistencies or the things that make me go, what? I also have to chalk up to when Roy was having to decide what he could keep, that's where it's not necessarily everything was going to work perfectly. He tried really hard, but some things just were not going to work perfectly. So anything that makes me kind of go like, what, why does this feel like rushed? Why does this feel squeezed in? It's like, well, it's because he had to squeeze some things in.
Yeah.
But, you know, we have funny, the name like Jelly of Jam, like, sounds like Jelly Jam. And
yeah, I and didn't even have time for that character in the synopsis. I was, yeah. I was like, yeah. I got to leave some people and out.
This little green haired girl who's probably at the same age as Tip is here and brought in to be the interpreter because the Scarecrow and Jack Pumpkinhead have convinced themselves that they can't understand each other because they're from different countries. And she's like, she talks to both of them and she's playing with them. she deliberately plays with them by misinterpreting what one says to the other. And it's hilarious until she finally says, well, of course I can understand you. We all speak the same language. And it's like, wow, the Scarecrow's brain is not working that well, but which also is a funny conceit because like, yes, the Scarecrow has a brain, but he's actually not as smart as we want to think that he is. So it's like just delightful, fun things like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff that I had to leave out just because I was like, this synopsis is mm-hmm. getting too long. Like, this is just getting yeah. way too oh, involved. Yeah. I didn't hit the story beat. So, yeah.
General Ginger. And her name being spelled with J's, not G's.
It's, yes. Yes.
She's a trip.
Yeah. I like her, you know, her group of soldiers that all look exactly the same. And then, you know, yeah. the mice come running out of the Scarecrow's body and they all run because they're girls, you know, girls are afraid of mice. Girls. Okay. There's the, all right.
It's just a little bit of misogyny in there. Just a little bit.
It's but all over it's the place.
It's trying to be harmless misogyny. That's all. Yeah. and, you know, and all the other girls are wearing like a single color uniform, but Ginger has the rainbow skirt, which mm-hmm. makes her stand out. And like, oh, she's, it's a great design. I just love that.
I love that Marvel did it as a treasury. It was $1.50 mm-hmm. for 80 plus pages. A good deal. So
yeah.
That's not something I ever thought we would cover on the show. But, you know, I'm glad you mentioned it, Tim.
Oh, I'm glad I did, too. But well, you know, and like you said, the artwork is so great. It just needed the size of paper that the treasury lets you do. And like you said, those great close-ups of Mamba. I was like, oh, she's Mombi. She's just pretty, really creepy. She is a... what is it from Tales from the Crypt sort of character, right. You know?
Yeah.
So it's like, ooh, but yeah, the artwork just deserved it. And the mouse story they wanted to put in, they couldn't have gotten it into a single issue, even a double sized issue. So it kind of needed this format for you to get the whole thing at once. Yeah. It's a great book. It's like, yeah, I'm glad I mentioned it when you asked me about treasuries. Cause boy, I will admit your show has done a great job covering treasuries because I was looking. It's like, man, you covered this one. You covered this one. You covered this one. I can't think of ones I haven't covered yet. So came down. This one, one other were the only ones left. And it's like, yeah, this is a fun one to do. It really just off the beaten track.
Yeah. I love it. I love when someone points something out that I didn't think we'd ever get to. So it was awesome. So, well, Tim, thank you so much for coming on and doing the show. You know, it's always fun talking to you and I'm happy to have you on another one of my shows. So thank you for doing this.
Woo. Yes, I'm getting my card punched yet again. I'm loving it.
So,
how many more until I get a free coffee?
Well, again, we'll work that out off air with the prize.
Okay. All right. All right. That's good.
So, anyways, you don't want to make other people jealous. So why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Sure. Well, you can find me on the dumpster fire that is Twitter under TimPrice17. You also can find me on my podcast, The Outcasters, which is on the Right On Network. You can follow us on Twitter at BatOutcasters. And you can find our show at our website, thehuntresspodcast.com, because it's on the same feed as The Huntress Podcast. So you see how we figured all that out. We made all that work. But yeah, and I'm also on another show on that podcast network called the Batgirl Cassandra Cain podcast. And we're doing lots of fun things over there. We're getting into brand new comics. I'm doing Batman and the Outsiders from the 80s on the Outcasters, which has been fantastic. And it's been a great time.
It's a great show. I was lucky enough to guest on the Outcasters podcast, and it's a super book and it's a great show. That and you've been doing a great job covering it. So
thank you.
I do have to ask, like, how far are you going to go? Are you going to go into like the later iterations of the Outsiders?
That's the question I wrestle with far too much. First I'm going to throw it out there. Thank you. It was so great having you on that episode to talk about that Christmas issue. That was fantastic.
I love that comic
so much fun.
That
was so much fun. I'm definitely doing we're going to go through the Baxter series.
Right.
We have to do that because that's more Jim Aparo artwork. So we have to do that.
Great series. Great. I never missed an issue of that series.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Loved it. Loved it. And anytime you want to be back on, you need to let me know.
Okay.
You need to let me know. Whether we go to the 90s series or not is, I'm still considering it. I just don't know. I kind of want to continue because of Mike W. Barr's involvement, but I've revisited a few of the issues recently and it's like, I'm not sure if I'm finding my joy with it. I'll put it that way. So I've got to be able to find my joy with it, but it's not off the table. At this point, it's just not off the table.
Okay. Fair enough. Okay. Well, again, Tim, thank you so much for coming on the show. And thanks, everybody, for listening. I want you to stay tuned. I'm going to run some podcast promos. And when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
Batman wouldn't help them. So now the team's on their own. Black Lightning, Geoforce, Halo, Katana, Looker, Metamorpho. People of power with a new purpose. They are The Outsiders.
The Outcasters continues its coverage of The Outsiders, and Mike W. Barr's team for the 80s has big changes on the way, with a new home, a new title, and coming soon, the Baxter series. You can find the show on Right On Network with your favorite podcatcher, or listen at thehuntresspodcast.com, and follow us on Twitter at @BatOutcasters, because to live outside the law or on Twitter, you must be honest.
L'amour, l'amour. That's French for love.
Dear Reader, Season 2. Join me, Stella, as I look at the 1936 play The Women by Claire Booth Luce and its three cinematic adaptations from 1939, 1956, and 2008. Does the play highlight the complicated aspects of female friendship or display the cattiness of women when in competition with each other and with time? Listen and find out. Coming soon to the Fire and Water Podcasting Network.
Mary Haynes, what is all this?
I've had 2 years to grow claws, Mother. Jungle Ray!
And it's time for listener feedback, and these are the comments we got on Treasury Cast Episode 78, Batman War on Crime, with my guest Dan Greenfield. First up is Matt Sorois, who says, thanks for another enjoyable episode. Batman War on Crime came out in 1999. It seems like my friend and I were only just talking about Ross doing these Treasury-sized books and how excited we were to see them, how we remembered having Treasury comics when we were little. Now, I realize that Batman War on Crime is now as old as Treasury editions were when this book came out. I need to go sit down. Bucky749 says, a great episode, and the art. Wow, you could take any page in that book and frame it. That's true of pretty much any of these Alex Ross Treasury editions, Bucky. Edo Boznar says, Dan is a really great guest whenever there's a Batman book to discuss. As usual, I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, especially the parts about Batman / Bruce needing to strike a balance between punching out bad guys and actually doing something to address the wider problems / causes of crime. Actually, this particular book, I am definitely interested in reading it given the subject matter. However, I again have to be the dissenting voice about the art. You don't have to be, Ado. As I've said a number of times before when the topic comes up, I really don't like the type of hyper-realistic art Ross employed in this book. In fact, now that I've seen samples of it, I wish he had used the same style as that in the recent Fantastic Four book, which I think is really attractive. Chuck Coletta says, another very informative conversation. I must say I was most interested in the comments comparing this Treasury to the most recent Batman movie, which I loathe. Batman used to be my favorite character, but he's so far away from the Jim Aparo version that got me hooked on comics that I avoid him now more often than not. Ross's take on Batman here is as grim and gritty as I ever want to see the character. I've purchased this and the other Ross Dini books several times over in various formats. They are great stories that truly capture the essence of the heroes. Looking forward to future episodes covering the remaining titles. Me too, Chuck. Captain Entropy says, what a terrific episode about an amazing book. Rob and Dan, I strongly agreed with every opinion you expressed about Batman in general and War on Crime in particular. I'm somewhere between Dan and Chuck on the 22 Batman movie, but I may need to see it again, having heard Dan's insights. In my headcanon, the way Batman and Bruce Wayne operate here is the way he, they always operate. It's the only effective way to do it. The special operations forces I used to support provided medical treatment to the locals in the day and did direct action raids at night. They ran economic development projects, advised local leaders, and trained host nation forces in everything from marksmanship to ethics. Those activities are how you gather information, build rapport, and gain access that you need to stop the bad guys. Those actions are also more likely to change underlying conditions and have a lasting impact in capturing this year's terrorist shadow governor of the district. Of course, That disruption is also necessary. It interrupts their attack cycle and often creates the conditions or provides the information that enable the next operation. When I was on active duty, I used to say that everything I need to know about counterinsurgency, I learned from Batman. I had a lot of other education on the topic, but it all matched what I read in the Bronze Age comics. When I said it, I meant Bruce Wayne also. And another thing, a Batman comic where all he does is find criminals and beat them up is fine every once in a while. It's basically an 80s Steven Seagal movie or a modern Liam Neeson one, nearly all vicarious catharsis about injustice in the world. That's the same feeling we get in this one when Bruce watches Gordon take away the evil plutocrat. But this story offers so much more than that, and Batman comics are always capable of offering much more. Maybe they're doing so again under the new regime. Dr. Ann says, great episode. I love these books. It's funny how Dini and Ross can be both optimistic and pessimistic in these books. Maybe pessimistic is too strong. Both in the Superman and in Batman books, they are forced to see that they will unlikely win their war, but they can win some battles here and there. As you say, the Bruce Wayne bits are just as wonderful, if not more wonderful, than the Batman pieces. I love how he wants to throttle the horrible businessman. But as always, the art is what really makes this shine. That pic of Marcus at the time of his parents' murder is etched in my mind. As you were discussing it, I could just see it. Hope the other volumes in the series are covered. The Wonder Woman one might be my favorite of them all. It's very interesting, Ange. Siskoid from this very network says, what a great episode. I co-sign everything you guys said. Thank you, Siskoid. Brett Michael Young says, great show, Rob and Dan. Always great to hear from Dan. I love 13 to mention, eagerly wait the 13 best page 13s from the 13th issue of a series article. I think Chris Franklin is hard at work at that, Brett. Also, Dan sounds exactly like a reporter from the Golf Channel named Steve Sands. Same cadence and everything. It's uncanny to the point that I'm wondering if they're the same guy. Does Dan have any thoughts on the upcoming Masters tournament? Also, can you help me with my sand wedge follow through? I'll hang up and listen. I have some of the Alex Ross treasuries, but the Batman one has somehow eluded me. My favorite thing about Ross's art is how he always ties the heroes into regular people's lives. This is where his art style shines. Ross masterfully shows how a guy dressed as a bat can look amazing or mystical or larger than life to normal people. By the way, every time you guys mentioned Bayside, the Saved by the Bell theme played in my head. I'm not proud of it, but there you go. Very brave of you to admit, Brett. And then finally, Paul Ken from this very network, like Siskoid, says, a bit late, but finally listened to the episode today. Great podcast on a great book. Dan is a fun guest for sure and very insightful. I love these books when they came out more than 20 years ago. Yikes. But the discussion has really inspired me to reread these stories. Like Dan, I enjoyed the Batman as being as close to a Bronze Age Batman that we were going to get in the movies. I did not catch the homages in the movie to this book, but I'm definitely going to try and find them now. Finally, I love the story about how Dan and his wife trade off their fandoms. I mentioned this great idea to my wife, who simply said, yeah, no. I'm there with you, Paul. Points for trying, though. Again, thanks, everybody, for the feedback. That was just terrific. I love reading your comments here on the air. Big thanks to our pal Tim Price for stopping by and talking about the marvelous Land of Oz. Like I said with him, I never thought I would get to any of the Oz books on Treasury Cast, and I'm finally happy to get to them because they were part of Marvel's Treasury history, and they deserve to be covered. So thank you so much, Tim. So that's going to do it for this episode of Treasury Cast. You can find this show, all the back episodes, on our website, finewaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. We're always talking comics and treasuries in general over on Twitter at Treasury Comics. If you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcasts. There you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Jeff Pollier, Brett Young, and Mark Balbus for their support of Treasury Cast. I really appreciate it. One housekeeping note. In the next episode of Treasury Cast for April is going to come a little earlier than normal. Generally, Treasury Cast drops like this one around the third or fourth week of the month. But next episode, because of various scheduling, is going to come earlier in the rotation. So just be on the lookout for it. And so if you can get your comments in a little bit sooner than normal, that would be great. That way I can read them on the air. But don't worry, if you miss the cutoff, I'll make sure to catch them in the episode after that, because I want to make sure that every comment that people are nice enough to leave here on the show gets mentioned. That's going to do it. Thanks for listening. We will see you next month. But until then, go big or go home.
Original Wizard of Oz on video cassette with the songs everybody loves.
Through the rainbow.
The witch everybody loves. and for just $29.95.
Oh, George, that's your...
So follow the yellow brick road to your video store and say...
I've got to see the wizard.
The original Wizard of Oz for just $29.95.